Many of us struggle to cope with the complexity of our nation's public health care system. What stories about life without health insurance can be found in an ER? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Waiting Room is an award-winning documentary about an emergency department in Oakland, California. We'll talk with the director and producer of the film, Peter Nix, who's visiting Iowa. We'll also explore the challenges in Iowa's ERs and how the Affordable Care Act might change emergency care with Peter Damiano and Michael Miller of the University of Iowa. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Many Americans and Iowans struggle with the complexity of our nation's public health care system. What stories about life without health insurance can be found in an emergency room? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we'll explore the challenges in Iowa's ERs specifically and how the Affordable Care Act might change emergency care in the state. We'll be talking with Peter Damiano with the University of Iowa. Also, Dr. Michael Miller is with us. But first, the ER as the subject of a film. The Waiting Room is an award-winning documentary about an emergency department in Oakland, California. Now, this film goes behind the doors of an American public hospital struggling to care for a community of largely uninsured patients. Here's an excerpt.
Deep breath. So you guys hear that 110-50 blood pressure? Oh, there we go. Good. You're waking up a little.
When we get the ring down from the paramedics that a trauma is on the way, literally 12 to 15 people stop whatever they're doing to focus on this one trauma. If several traumas roll in at the same time, that is a huge impact on the rest of the waiting room. People with legitimately serious illnesses can get bumped over and over and over again for the trauma service.
The Waiting Room, an award-winning documentary. It will be shown tonight at 7 p.m. Tonight, Tuesday, April 9th, at the University of Iowa's Pomerantz Center, beginning at 7 o'clock. The film will be followed by a discussion with the director and producer of The Waiting Room, who is in our studio today, Peter Nix. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Tell us how you got the idea to make this film and why you feel it's an important documentary to be seen and heard at this time.
Well, I came out of grad school. My wife and I came out of grad school at the same time, and she got her master's in speech pathology, and her first job was at Highland Hospital. And so early
that's
on—
That's the hospital focused on where you portray the waiting room.
Yeah, that's where we shot the film. You know, this was in 99, well before healthcare became such a political, you know, football and such a divisive political issue. I mean, we had Hillarycare before Obamacare, but it was nothing like, I think, what it became. And so my antenna went up early on of a film about a relationship between a community and a public institution that really wasn't about healthcare, the healthcare crisis per se, but was really going to look more about this community and how they navigate a safety net system on a given day. And that's really was the impetus for the film.
Okay. Now, did you have a goal going in, what you wanted to— You obviously wanted to tell the story of this waiting room, but a larger goal because of the context that you mentioned.
The goals changed. You know, so documentaries take a long time to get funded and to produce. And so between, you know, 1999 and really 2009, which is really when we began making the film, everything changed in terms of the focus on healthcare, the tone of the conversation around healthcare, how we thought about the insured and the uninsured. And what I noticed was that a lot of the people who did not have a voice in that conversation were these people who were stuck in waiting rooms at public hospitals at Highland and Oakland and all over the country. And so we sort of decided to focus on the waiting room as the stage from which to tell this story at this moment when it was a big public policy question, but that the people who were being most impacted didn't have a voice in that conversation. So we wanted to make a film that would allow their voices to come forward at this moment when we had a lot of questions. And we didn't know what the outcome, you know, of the Affordable Care Act was going to be at the time. It hadn't been passed. You know, there were elections that still had to happen. And so we were wading into it, not knowing, you know, what was going to be the end result. But we knew that the constant was going to be the lives of these people and what they had to deal with day in and day out was not going to be changing in the foreseeable future, and that those stories had to be told.
Some incredible narratives that you found over the course of how long did you film? It almost seems like a 24-hour period, but I imagine it was longer.
We spent actually, before we made the film, we did a digital storytelling project, which was based on the premise of just going into the waiting room, and we had a question, which was, what are you waiting for? And we found that people just wanted to share a little bit of who they were as human beings and not really talk about the politics of healthcare. Mm. And we put all these little moments up on the web, and that really set the tone for what the film would become. So we had about a couple of years on the ground before we began rolling on what would become the film. And we made the decision to focus on the waiting room. That literally, like the week we made that decision, we heard that they were going to renovate the whole waiting room to try to improve the wait times.
You wanted it before that.
Yeah. And so we knew we wanted to do a day in the life film, that the film would be a composite day in the life so that the audience can get a visceral sense of what it's like to navigate the safety net system. And so we had to quickly, you know, shoot all the footage that ended up being in the film. It was about 6 weeks worth of shooting. And we didn't spend any more than 24 hours with any given patient. It was that day that they were there.
Okay, so all the patients that we meet there were there at a certain time, obviously, but they are not, their visits did not coincide.
Right. It ended up being a composite. Roughly 50% of the film was shot on one particular day. There was just one day that was, you know, very, it was one of those days. But yeah, it's a composite day in the life.
It gives a real good picture of what goes on in an emergency care facility like this in Oakland, California. We see a lot of confusion about the concept of triage, giving the attention first to those who need it most. Let's listen to this excerpt from your film, The Waiting Room, that concerns that. And I believe, CJ, a head nurse, is explaining, and I'm sure she has to have this conversation X number of times during a shift.
Every day.
Every day, multiple times, about the order in which patients are taken. Let's listen.
What was your diagnosis that they discharged him with?
He was just shot. That's all they said. But he's going numb now. So on them papers, on the instruction papers, it states if you're going numb, fatigue, or any of that, they're in my car to come right back to emergency. We're here and nobody is doing anything.
Being that it's an emergency department, we don't take people in based on when they arrive. Just because you get here first doesn't mean that you go back first. People with more emergent or urgent situations go back to an emergency department first. There's people that have been out here waiting for a really long time. The emergency department is completely full. The beds in the department in the hospital are full, so nobody moves. So unfortunately, it's not just you guys. There's people coming in from the ambulance as well.
So you really see that the staff has to provide a level of transparency, not just professional service. They're doing their best, but they are giving every patient that comes in, this is what we deal with, folks.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that we discovered. Being on the ground at this hospital in the waiting room was how it was being utilized. And I think we kind of knew, you know, intellectually that the waiting room had become increasingly used as primary care. But when you see it and you see that tension between people who, you know, need emergency care and people who are there, you know, because they have a fever or because they're filling a prescription, you know, medicine or something like that, that you see those patients competing with each other, it's not a good combination. And we wanted to try to capture the mechanics of the system so that people understood that in a public hospital, the flow of patients relates to how the ER is being used, and that so many people are using the waiting room as their primary care doctor. That was really surprising to us.
Peter Nix is my guest. He's the director and producer of The Waiting Room, an award-winning documentary, which will be screened this evening at 7 p.m. at the Pomeranz Center at the University of Iowa, followed by a discussion. A little bit about the filmmaking here, because I found that remarkable in watching it. There is no narrator, and having been on the audio side of creating something like this, you as a filmmaker had a big challenge here to tell a story, not letting a narrator bridge any gaps or explain anything that got left out. Why did you make that decision?
What I saw And what I have seen as a documentary filmmaker over the last, 10, 12 years of my career is documentaries that have become very polemic, very activist films that take a very strong point of view that the filmmaker determines sort of what the problem is and tries to get the audience to think in a certain way about a certain issue. And what we saw was an opportunity to reframe. What we wanted to do is reframe the conversation around healthcare in more human terms, mm-hmm. and allow people to empathize. Because I think, anytime you have a big public policy question or debate, and it tends to get framed in political terms, there's a breakdown in empathy, and that does not, from my point of view as a storyteller, that doesn't really lend itself to solving these problems on a national scale. So we wanted the audience to feel instead of think.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to one of the narratives here. You have a number of really compelling narratives that we see, that we follow throughout the, hour and 10-minute long film. A little girl, I believe her name Deja, she has a severe throat infection. An older man with bone spurs in his spine, a middle-aged man diagnosed with a stroke. Another case is a man, a relatively young man who comes in who has a testicular tumor. We're going to hear a little bit of that exchange, but tell us who this is.
Eric Morgan, he's a young guy, he artist, and he had symptoms and didn't know what it was and went to a bunch of HMOs to try to, see a doctor, and they all turned him down, but he found one that would take him and allow him to put it on a credit card. But after a series of visits, they realized that there was an expensive surgery and they're not going to let you put a $30,000 surgery on a credit card. So at that point, he was discharged from the private HMO and ended up at Highland.
Okay, and he winds up here. His age, approximately?
He was about 27.
And he's here with his wife or girlfriend, and we'll hear them in this little cut from audio cut from The Waiting Room, this documentary film. Let's have a listen.
And what's wrong with you today?
I have a testicular tumor. And I need to have surgery on it as soon as possible.
Where were you diagnosed?
Over at Kaiser.
Do you have any paperwork from them?
So they did all the tests. Do you need to see them now?
I just want to know if they did. They.
We have an ultrasound, a CT scan, a chest X-ray, all the blood work. So basically, we went through all the tests, and the surgery was supposed to take place today. And they let us go through all the tests, and they canceled the surgery yesterday.
At Kaiser?
Yeah.
That makes us Washington.
We're not members.
Oh. I don't have any coverage, and I don't have any insurance. Right
so
now.
Why did they tell you that before they scheduled it?
Well, they were asking us all along whether we're members, but we always said no.
An excerpt from The Waiting Room. Filmmaker Peter Nix, this immediately jumped out as me as a narrative that could be replicated how many times in this country? A young man in his – he's a 20-something young man. Of course, most of us did feel immortal in our 20s and didn't feel the need for health insurance. I don't think it's explained here, but for whatever reason, until one day out of the blue, you have a healthcare crisis. Is that why he's in this film?
Yeah, we wanted to pick archetypes of different pressure points on the healthcare system. And so we filmed all these different people. And then when putting the film together, we wanted to make sure that there are different characters who represented these different pressure points on the community. And we felt that that was one that we had heard about and read about, these young people who, can have a life-changing medical condition completely take them by surprise. And so how is the system equipped to handle somebody like that? Young people tend, to have that feeling of immortality and tend to not really think about, the impact of a significant health challenge on their finances, on their future. And so it was important. We felt it was important to have that character in the film.
Peter Nix, I was amazed and awed, as I am with so many documentary films that are in this class, this excellent class of documentary film, where the people don't appear at all to act like they're being filmed or observed. The man with testicular cancer, very intimate conversations between the little girl, Deja, with a throat problem, her mother, her father. How do you as a filmmaker get them to forget you are there?
It's the goal of any, I think, documentarian. And you talk to photographers, they'll explain it to you too, is that moment of capturing the truth in someone's face or in someone's life. It's very difficult because people's initial instinct is to perform for you. They want to be seen in certain ways. But there's always that moment when their character, when someone's true character is revealed. Usually, that's in a moment of crisis or a moment of deep trust between the subject and the documentarian. Sometimes that takes months to develop, mm-hmm. Or it takes a crisis. In our case, we didn't know these people. We had known them for, a few minutes, at the moment where they decided to allow us to follow them. But they were in crisis. And so I think that those crises allowed our cameras and our presence to kind of dissolve into the background of what they were dealing with at that moment. And we were selective. We picked people that we thought we had chemistry with and mm-hmm. that we thought would be comfortable with the camera. But after that, it was all about they were focused on their personal health issue, and we became secondary.
I see how that happens with the crisis, because up to the crisis point, you are foremost in their mind. And when the crisis comes, that eclipses you, and you get to observe.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another clip from this film, your film, The Waiting Room. And it goes to the point of how staff, how doctors are coping with such a system, and we want to get into that in our second half hour as well. Here's this clip. I don't know if you know which one I'm talking about. There's a young ER doctor describing the overall problem he faces and how it's illustrated in the case of one stroke victim. Let's listen to it. I think it explains itself. And then you can tell us a little bit about this man, this doctor really pleading for a way to have a man who suffered a stroke receive the care he should.
Unfortunately, we see a lot of patients coming in with very treatable conditions who don't have access to a regular doctor. I know that I can make someone better in the short term, but the ER is not the place to manage someone's overall health. It's going to require a heck of a lot more follow-up that I can't provide. So no medical appointments for the next couple months, so I just played basically a guilt trip on the neurology team saying someone has to take care of him, so she's going to take him in her private clinic in a month. Mm-hmm. That's the best we can do. We're going to take what we can get.
This is really amazing because you have the doctor, the ER doctor, here in the position of being really a beggar for services, advocate for services. You don't normally think of a doctor having to be put in that position, Peter Nix.
Yeah, and you have to be clever, you have to be creative, sort of MacGyver things. But this is an incredibly talented and resourceful group of doctors. Doug White is a fourth-year resident. Highland attracts some of the very best medical students in the country. I think last year it had the top match rate in the country, or one of the highest match rates, which means it's the most sought-after residency in the country because of all the trauma and because people are showing up with advanced stage diseases that you just don't see. You're not going to get that kind of training at other hospitals. On top of that, they're dealing with resource issues, and they're dealing with having to make do with very little. And preceding that little clip was an extended conversation he had trying to get this guy into a clinic. And often it's several months to try to get people into primary care clinics. And so that was part and parcel of what we also observed, was that long wait time to get into, not just to back to see an ED physician from the waiting room, but once you get back to the ED, then getting into a clinic is an even longer wait.
One of the aspects of your film that really appealed to me was you said you're focusing on the human story, but the personalities here, I felt myself asking the question, what type of personality from a staff point of view, not just doctors, not just nurses, but also administrators involved with the waiting room, what type of people, what type of mettle it takes to work in this atmosphere at this public hospital is amazing.
It's remarkable, and it's one of the surprising. I mean, I kind of had a sense of it because my wife, works there. Of the special individuals that populate, not just the ER, but the entire hospital. But it's a self-selecting group of people. It's akin to MASH a little bit, or it's a military kind of mentality, where a combat zone mentality. But obviously extends beyond that to a group of people who, especially the attending physicians who choose to stay there, and the clerks and the nurses, have a deep connection and empathy with that patient population that is very difficult to put into words. And it's a part of healthcare that is not really talked about a lot. It's a significant part of healthcare. And you see that with CJ, that nurse who is the first point of contact when people walk through her line. Well, she was born at Highland, you know. And so when people come through her line, they're her neighbors, her friends, her relatives. And so she has a cultural competency that is really profound and cannot be really replicated at other places.
She has this incredible tough love charm where she doesn't put up with anything. She's a straight shooter, but she is nice at the same time.
She gives you humanity and she gives you dignity. So she treats everybody the same, whether you're, you know, homeless and you smell, or whether you're a laid off, you know, you're an entrepreneur who or an artist, or you know someone else. She gives everybody that dignity. And I think the rest of the staff, we were just really, you know, struck by the nurses and the doctors in that ER and how they related to those patients. It's a very difficult patient population, and it's not for everyone. And so it's a part of the story that we really wanted to have come through.
Okay, Peter Nix, we have a couple minutes before we take a break. Tell me a little bit about, you touched on this a little bit earlier. I think this film comes at a time of high politics, intense controversy, partisanship, hyper-partisanship about healthcare in this country, as 2014 is the year that most of the Affordable Care Act will be implemented. Talk about the funding of this film and how the politics of our country figured into making it.
We had to raise about $1 million for the project, for both the storytelling project and the film. And, you know, the biggest chunk was from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. MacArthur Foundation came in with a big chunk, the California Endowment, San Francisco Film Society, San Francisco Foundation. So it was a collection of larger and smaller foundations. Our challenge was in convincing them that a non-polemic film about healthcare could actually make an impact on the conversation around healthcare. And those were in making the film. A lot of the sort of back and forth was around that question, like how much context did the film need to give the audience? You know, could you create a film that just gave the audience a visceral, immersive experience without any narration, without any text cards or infographics? And, we decided to go that route because we felt that it was really vital at this moment to allow an audience into a space in a community so that we could build empathy for people who don't have, you know, insurance. And that these are people beyond the headlines, beyond statistics, who are just like you and I. And, you know, nothing is guaranteed in this life. And, you know, whether you lose your job or whether you find yourself confronting a mental illness or a drug problem or alcohol problem or what have you, you could find yourself relying on the safety net healthcare system.
Very quickly, and you'll be with us after the break too, do you feel you've changed the discussion? Are you a small part of changing the discussion in this country with this film?
I hope so. I mean, what we wanted to say with the film is the system may be broken, but the people are not. And I think that the film brings forward a humanity that's hard to ignore. And I think, you know, the critics have loved the film. Audiences love the film. It's, you know, we got shortlisted for an Academy Award. So it rose to that level of attention, and people are looking at it and listening to it and paying attention. That's the first step.
Peter Nix is with us this hour, director and producer of The Waiting Room, an award-winning documentary about an emergency department in Oakland, California. It goes behind the doors of an American public hospital struggling to care for a community of largely uninsured patients. And when we come back, Peter Nix will be with us, as well as Peter Damiano. He's a director, also public policy of the Public Policy Center, also a professor of preventive and community dentistry at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Michael Miller, the chief safety officer, clinical medical director at the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We'd like to hear from you. Tell us about your visit, a visit that you've had to the ER that somehow didn't meet your expectations, or perhaps it did. Anything that surprised you. Perhaps you visited an ER in Iowa because you were using it to get primary care because you're uninsured. Tell us about it. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. River to River, back in just a few minutes. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Recently, I'm sure you caught it, President Obama issued an apology after saying at a Democratic fundraiser that the California Attorney General, who happens to be a woman, was by far, quote, the best-looking Attorney General in the country. Tomorrow on this program, Politics Day, of course, Wednesday, we'll talk about gender and politics, Margaret Thatcher's legacy, and also potential candidates for an open congressional seat in Iowa. Join our conversation, Politics Wednesday, tomorrow. Today, we're talking about emergency care in Iowa. Many Americans, Iowans, having to cope with the complexity of our nation's public health care system. So we have here with us Peter Nix, filmmaker, director, and producer of an award-winning documentary film called The Waiting Room, about an emergency department in Oakland, California. Tonight at 7 p.m. at the Pomerantz Center, it will be screened, followed by a discussion. And joining in that discussion later on tonight, we have Peter Nix with us, but also Peter Damiano is with us. He's the director of the Public Policy Center and professor of preventive and community dentistry at the University of Iowa. Peter Damiano, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Sitting next to Peter, Dr. Michael Miller, Chief Safety Officer and Clinical Medical Director at the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Miller, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I wanted to make sure that we get your reaction, first of all, to this film. Most of our listeners got a sense of what that documentary film is about, ER center trying to cope with the system that it has, with the resources that it has. Peter Damiano, can you tell me, first of all, the relevance of having Peter Nix here? How much are Iowa's emergency rooms and waiting rooms like the ones that we witnessed in Oakland in this film?
Well, I will turn some of that over to Mike here, because as the ER doc, he's going to have a little more expertise, but I can talk about why we were interested in bringing the film here. First off, we study the healthcare system at the Public Policy Center and try to provide policymakers with background information to help them understand about access to care, cost of care. And we have a study going on right now funded by the Commonwealth Fund that looks at the impact of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, on safety net providers. The opportunity came up through a personal connection of Tony Paik, who's our social science program director, to Pete Nix to bring him in. And it was a great combination of policy relevance as well as interdisciplinarity and working with the arts and humanities people on campus. And so we have a whole group of co-sponsors that work together to bring him here. We're very excited about the event tonight.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the ER. What are the challenges, Dr. Miller, facing our ERs at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics? But also, I know you have you're familiar with ERs around the state.
I am, and I do want to thank Peter for his movie. As emergency physicians, this really sheds a lot of light, I think, to the complexity of emergency care and some of the hurdles that we have to battle. I think first off, I'd like to say I can speak for the emergency physicians across the country at the University of Iowa and in the state that we're committed to take care of all comers regardless of their ability to pay. That's really our mission, and that's ultimately always going to be our goal. There are definitely differences, but there's so much similarity. When you watch this movie, these are the exact same issues we deal with throughout all of emergency medicine. So even in the smallest ERs across the state of Iowa, to the largest one here at the university. One small difference I think that we sometimes forget here in Iowa is, as a small state, the University of Iowa is the only level one quaternary referral center.
What does that mean?
Which basically means we're where the buck stops. We have every specialist that you need.
Does that have anything to do with you not turning people away as well or
it,
not?
It does, because if other hospitals don't have a service, they can send them to us. In larger cities like Chicago and San Francisco and out east, there are centers maybe four or five within three or four blocks of each other that can provide the exact same care. So there's a little bit more of spreading the wealth, as I would say, where in Iowa, we're pretty much it. We get referrals from the whole state, Illinois, Minnesota, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska. So we kind of take it all on our shoulders at this point. But I do think that the movie The Waiting Room really does bring out a lot of the issues that we have to deal with on a daily basis.
Talking about emergency care this hour on River to River, if you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps tell us about a visit you've had to the ER recently. Did it meet your expectations? Anything surprise you? Perhaps you went there as an uninsured person to seek treatment for some acute problem. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to Des Moines. Cheryl is joining us from Des Moines. Listening to this conversation, Cheryl, thanks for joining us. Do you have an experience that comes to mind as we discuss this?
Yes, I do. Right now I'm out of work and I am on Social Security, but it's small payment. And right now I am on Medicare, but I cannot afford to go to the regular doctors because I can't afford the deductible that needs to be paid for Medicare. And right now I'm going this afternoon, in fact, to a free clinic that I'm fortunate is available in Des Moines, and it's not available throughout Iowa, there, unfortunately. And I'm hoping that they will pass the extension to Medicare in Iowa instead of the governor's alternative plan, which covers less and no pharmacy. Anyway.
Right. And the extension of Medicaid is as I would think, what you're referring to. How do you find this impacts your health, Cheryl? Do you find yourself putting off conditions that you think, well, if I had insurance, I would get them treated?
Well, I'm looking at my Medicare coverage as that. If I need something like if I have a stroke or a stroke, I can go to the doctor. I can go to the hospital. But other than that, I don't want to go to the hospital or to the doctor because you still have to pay the deductible. Mm-hmm. And many people can't afford that in Iowa. Many people are unemployed. There are people who also aren't eligible for the state plans. And even if they are eligible for the state plan, they can be treated at Broadlands in Des Moines, or you can go to the wonderful Iowa City hospitals. In fact, I've taken advantage of the dental care at Broadlands when they sent the dentists and dental students from the Iowa State universities to Broadlands for their emergency treatment.
Cheryl, thank you for your story. I want to get a little reaction from this here. Cheryl calling from Des Moines here. We have these individual stories certainly brought out in the film, but I guess the larger question, and it is embodied by Cheryl here, is how smart is it of us as a society to have people not put off primary care and seek their primary care or in an emergency room or in a setting where it's perhaps further on down the line in terms of urgency than it was before? Dr. Miller.
Sure. And Cheryl, thank you very much for bringing that up. As a society, I think we can all agree that it's not good for any of us. I mean, as an emergency physician, it's frustrating because we can treat someone and help them and try to treat them when they come in with their stroke. But had they had good management of their cholesterol, their blood pressure, their diabetes, and primary care, which is way cheaper to prevent that stroke, is really where society is going to gain the most benefit. But right now, we don't put the most dollars there. And so that kind of goes into how do we motivate not only each other but our providers as well to provide the safest care. And preventive care always has gotten the short end of the stick.
Mm-hmm. Peter Damiano, tell us about something called accountable care organizations. They are to be part of the new Affordable Care Act. Phased in when?
Well, they're being phased in right now primarily for Medicare, and then they're going to be phasing in, or other payers such as private insurance companies are also looking at setting up accountable care organizations. And the big change for that relating to what we're talking about is that right now we're primarily in a fee-for-service environment. And even though we've been talking about trying to keep people out of emergency rooms if they are going in for primary care and this or that, there's still an incentive for the facility to want these people to come in because they're getting paid for each one to come in. In this accountable care organization where we're in this what they call a shared savings model, you're going to get paid for a whole population of people. And so keeping them from coming into the emergency room at the end of the year, if you hold down costs, you'll get a reward for that, or keeping them from going into the hospital or having hospital readmissions. And the hard thing right now for hospitals in Iowa and around the country is that for Medicare patients, for example, it might be about 20% of their patients are in this shared savings model, and the rest are in a fee-for-service model. And so it's a real difficult management challenge.
Do you think, though, the introduction of these account care organizations, ACOs, will do something to hold down costs?
Well, we've seen the last 2 years nationally, we've had the lowest increase in costs in 50 years. Now, whether that's totally due to the rollout of these ACOs is very arguable. But I do think it's changing the mentality and looking at how do we care for populations, preventive care, getting care outside into the community-based settings and care coordination activities, nutritionists, others for diabetics and people with, you know, other chronic disease entities, that that's going to help keep them healthy and reduce costs more than going into healthcare providers.
If your eye is on the budget there too in this with the ACOs, won't you, as an administrator, as a manager, try to avoid high-risk patients or higher-risk patients?
Well, that's one of the challenges, and that's part of what we're studying. And in Massachusetts, they found that even though, you know, the other piece we haven't talked about with the Affordable Care Act is the insurance coverage that's going to be starting, the need for the safety net actually went up rather than went down, because you're going to have more people with private insurance, even more than are going to be gaining public insurance. And then those people fill up the healthcare delivery system on the private side, and that still puts pressures on the federally qualified health centers, emergency rooms, public hospitals, free clinics, as Cheryl mentioned, things like that. And so that's what we're trying to study. What are the impacts?
Let's go back to our phones with some personal experiences that you've had at the emergency room. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Joshua is with us in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for tuning in and for contributing. What would you like to tell us about?
Yeah, actually, I went to the ER last Thursday, had chest pains, was unable to breathe very good, had all the symptoms of a heart attack, and after, I don't go to the hospital for anything. I'm one of those guys who just refuses to go, and so I finally went. I felt like I was just kind of treated like meat. I mean, I went in, and I said, no, I think I'm having a heart attack, and of course, everyone whisked around, and they, you know, did their job, threw me in a wheelchair, pushed me around, and hooked me up with stuff, and no one was talking to me. No one was telling me what's going on. And I'm sitting there kind of having a mini panic attack on top of it, going, okay, man, this is it. You know, I feel like the world's closing in on me and no one's talking to me. I'm just kind of whisked around. And then to find out I have a $3,000 bill now, I don't have insurance. I can't afford the insurance through my employer, and open enrollment's only once a year. So, you know, now I'm stuck with this huge bill, which, you know, that's it. I made the choice to go in there. But I just felt like there was no, like, all right, hey, sir, you know, this is what's going on and this is what we're looking for. I mean, I really had to pull that out of people. You know, toward the end, when I started settling down a little bit, they go, what are you doing? Why do you keep drawing my blood? What are you looking for? And,
Joshua, we hope everything turned out with the symptoms more of a panic attack rather than a heart attack.
I still have the problems. They wanted me to go to a cardiologist the following morning, but I can't afford it. I mean, $3,000 for the emergency room. I can't.
Yeah.
I don't have time to take off from work. I mean, I'll get written up if I take time off. So it's like I'm kind of just up the creek. So I'm just trying to, you know, not be physically active and eating aspirin and just trying to watch my diet now. But I feel like I'm kind of stuck. I don't want to be in debt the rest of my life, you know, for something like this. I don't feel like that's the way I want to live the rest of my life either, is owing money, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Joshua, thank you for sharing your story. We wish you all the best in getting that problem solved. Let's talk to Dr. Miller here. What about Joshua's story? You hear these types of stories, I'm sure, quite a bit.
Yeah, every single day. And Joshua, I appreciate you calling in and being part of this. This is, you raise a point of what is very difficult, and I think Peter even mentioned it before. I mean, the ERs every day are basically like a MASH unit. And that makes it a little bit difficult. And we work very hard on, you know, service excellence and customer service. But when you're acting like a MASH unit to try to keep people alive, that's where we lose that personal touch to some degree. And that's what we need to continue to work on. One thing related to that I think I'd like to just mention, if to put into context, which I think the Waiting Room film does very well, is, you know, preventive medicine is important, and as emergency physicians, we don't want to ever make it seem like there would be a roadblock to coming to the emergency department or to prevent patients from doing that. There's been some very good studies that, you know, a lot of payers like to look at the back-end diagnosis. So if we diagnose somebody like Joshua with indigestion, well, that's not an emergency diagnosis. We don't want to pay for that. However, his chief complaint is chest pain. And if you can imagine 300 people coming in with chest pain, our job is to quickly sort out the people that might die of that and who might have less than urgent conditions. And you can't separate those very easily. And that's why the triage nurse is so important and why that's a very difficult process. Joshua, I hope everything goes well, and we do understand the difficulties with follow-up, too. I think that goes to it as well.
Peter Damiano, you wanted to jump in here.
Well, I think Joshua's situation also points out a couple of misunderstandings, I think, often. Number one, about the uninsured, and that 70% of the uninsured are actually working people and their families. They're not people that aren't trying. They're not people that, you know, they work. They just happen to, what I say, they work at the wrong job. You know, it's very expensive if you are working, particularly in a lower wage job, to be able to purchase individual health insurance. Right now, a family policy nationally costs about $15,000 to $16,000. And so there's the median income in the United States is $50,000. So it's very difficult for anyone working in those jobs to do that. And then on top of it, that idea that they're just going to the emergency room willy-nilly, if you will, when they had other options, and they don't. And we know from a study that we did with kids in Iowa that of the quarter of the kids that did go to an emergency room, 70% went for something that didn't have to be seen in an emergency room, according to their parents, but they were they either had nowhere else to go, or they were actually a third of them were told to go there by another healthcare provider. And so we don't have a not good non-emergent situation, especially after hours or weekends or whatever, in many parts of the state. And so you end up driving that. And even the providers that don't want to work on the weekends, so they're saying, do they get a call, go to the ER. So it gets it's a lot more complicated.
Let's talk in the remaining 5 minutes quickly before our hour ends. Governor Branstad says he will continue work to get his health care program for low-income Iowans through our divided legislature rather than expanding the joint federal state health care program known as Medicaid. Some states, as we've been hearing in the news, have been signing up for the Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Some call it Obamacare. That's what Democrats in the Iowa Senate want to do. A number of Republican governors, like Governor Branstad, are proposing less generous plans for insuring low-income families. Now, the key here is IowaCare expires at the end of the year. Thousands of Iowans losing coverage if there's not an agreement on what to replace it with. Tell me, what are the possible futures that low-income Iowans face depending on what happens in the legislature? Dr. Miller, please.
So if I had a crystal ball, that would be a great thing to be able to predict. As emergency physicians in Iowa, we do support following the federal expansion for Medicaid. Because I believe that gives us the best reimbursement to be able to keep services alive. At this point, even with the IowaCare system, does not supply enough funds to actually run the business. So even if you rely heavily just on those systems, access will fail because there is not enough funds really coming in through those systems. So that's why we really need to get away from the old models and really start thinking fresh to try to figure out how to provide the best care.
Peter Damiano.
Well, we do the evaluation of the IowaCare program, and that program was never designed to take care of as many people. It's now up to 70,000 people that are enrolled in the IowaCare program. Plus, we've got in the neighborhood of 150,000 uninsured adults. And as an academic researcher, we're not going to wade into the politics of what the folks should do, but there is going to be a real challenge because with the way the Affordable Care Act law is set up, people under 100% of poverty are not going to be able to go into these private health insurance or the health insurance exchanges, the government exchanges that are going to be set up, these online marketplaces to purchase insurance that's subsidized. And so you're going to have a sort of a weird arrangement where the lowest income, most vulnerable people are not going to be able to get subsidized insurance, and people who are at higher incomes will, and there'll be few options if we're not careful in terms of how we proceed from here.
Dr. Miller, how will this – I know it's a bit of a crystal ball question. How do you expect the changes coming will change life and work in Iowa's ERs compared to how they are now? What are your chief concerns? Let me put it that way.
My chief concerns are kind of like Peter's already mentioned is where are the holes going to be? And we'll be there to be the safety net, but will that be for too big of a group of people? I also think that we continue to try to kind of guess our way through some of this. And I think the actually having enough physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants to actually care for the primary care of these patients, just that infrastructure is not there.
The demand will be so great, and we do not have the trained resources to do that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Let me give the last word to you, Peter Nix, filmmaker, director, producer of The Waiting Room, as you come into Iowa to observe what's going on here, What are your observations as someone from the outside observing our emergency care and the hopes that your film has for educating?
Well, going back to what the earlier caller, it's a recognition of some of those universals and, you know, having a guy come in and have nowhere else to go and then get this large bill. I think that that's a very familiar story. That was one of the storylines in our film. And it was one of the things that surprised us, actually, is that, hey, you know, people think, oh, public hospital, safety net hospital, you go in, but you actually come out with a bill. And it just reminds me that, you know, we're all on this journey together, whether we have health insurance, whether we don't have health insurance. And that's really, that was the message. That message of common humanity was something that we felt that the film could provide and something that could reframe this conversation around healthcare in more human terms rather than the politically divisive terms that have defined it in the last several years.
Thank you for joining us. Peter Nix, the director and producer of The Waiting Room. The Waiting Room will be shown tonight at 7 p.m. at the University of Iowa's Pomerantz Center, followed by a discussion. Also, thanks to Peter Damiano, director of the Public Policy Center and a professor of preventive and community dentistry at the University of Iowa, as well as Dr. Michael Miller, chief safety officer, clinical medical director at the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Tune in tomorrow, Politics Day, when we'll be talking about the politics of gender, also Margaret Thatcher's legacy, and potential candidates for an open Iowa congressional seat. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.